Welcome to a new episode of the India Independent Films Podcast. This is Rahul Desai, film critic for Film Companion. I have with me, as usual, Uday Bhatia, film critic for Mint. Both of us are back this week. We're going to be discussing two films, big Hollywood action film and one of the biggest Indian films to release this year. We're going to start with the film that everyone's talking about since last week, Adipurush, directed by Om Raut. Which is based on the Ramayana. It stars Prabhas. It's shot in Hindi and Telugu. It released simultaneously. Prabhas, Saif Ali Khan again as the villain. It has Kriti Sanon as Sita. It has Sunny Singh. It has a and it is for those of you unfamiliar with the Ramayana, though I doubt there's anyone like that in this country. I'd say this is basically about about when Ram teams up with Lakshman and Hanuman to go and rescue Sita, who's been abducted by Ravan in Lanka. It's as simple as that, but fortunately or unfortunately, the film has been at the center of many storms for the last few days. And I don't think it's been liked across the board, which is very interesting, which I'm very keen to talk about as well. Uday, let's start with your reactions to the film.
Let's go a little back, because actually I think the Adipurush story starts maybe when they released a teaser last year, sometime, and they expected it to, like, everyone to lose their minds, and people did lose their minds, but in a way that they weren't expecting, because there was 3 days of just incessant mockery of that. Yeah. It was just beautiful. And and they said, oh, this is just like an early version of the thing, and we have to work on the effects, and it's going to be so much better when you see, you know, see the final product and stuff. And I didn't have much faith that it was going to be much better, and as it turns out, it is not. And we'll come to the effects, because those are, the film kind of relies on that to an extent that's even greater than Brahmastra. And if you're pinning everything on your effects, you got to do something impressive, and this is kind of the opposite. It looks very silly at times, and but we'll get into that. So getting into this, just the weirdest thing first off, which I thought, was that they're not using the names by which these characters are best known. Instead, Ram becomes Raghav, Lakshman is Shesh, and Ravan is Lankesh, and Sita is Janki. And so on and so on. It's only when you get to like the really minor character like Sugriv and stuff that I think they have the same names. I wonder why this is, because no one's really, I think, asked them point blank. And it's I think people are guessing that it's because, like, nobody can. Then, you know, if something turns sour, which it has, they can't say that you've insulted the Ramayana, and they'll say this is not the Ramayana, this is the story of Raghav and Lankesh. I don't know, maybe it's that, but I don't know, did you have any theories as to why they may not have used the actual name, famous names?
Yeah, it's more or less for the reason I think you mentioned, because it's just like, it's sort of insurance, because I think everyone's sort of a little unsure about how things can be taken right now. There's a lot of fear, funnily enough, even amongst the people who are pandering to them. So oddly enough, a couple of weeks ago, I reviewed a short film called Sita. It's streaming on Disney Hotstar. It has Shreya Pilgaonkar. And it's a pretty brave short film, in the sense that it's based in modern day Banaras, and it's just about a lower caste kid, a child who finds a baby a dead baby at the steps of a temple, and he wants to cremate the baby. But the problem is, because he's lower caste, nobody is willing to cremate him along the ghats. A pandit turns him away, and his own caste people turn him away because they aren't sure about how it will be taken if a upper caste baby is sort of cremated there. So they're all a little scared, and he eventually comes across, when he's totally disillusioned with the adults around him, he comes across this very enigmatic woman. Obviously, she's a reincarnation of Sita, or maybe sort of a spirit version of that. And that's why Shriya Pilgaonkar, and even there in that short film, she talks to the child and basically gives him a little lecture about how even Sita herself wasn't allowed to cremate her father-in-law in the Ramayana, and that that Ram and Lakshman sort of didn't allow her to do that, and that patriarchy and that caste and all those discriminations are in our scriptures, and it's sort of carried on over the years. So obviously it's too much to explain to a child, which is a little heavy-handed, but I like the fact that, you know, a short film exists where there is a ancient Sita in a modern day setting. The only difference is she is named Janki in that as well, just like in Ramayana. So it's more or less the same thing, because if people point fingers at that short film, which is a fairly brave short film for what it's saying, it's basically saying that the Ramayana was flawed as well, and a lot of discrimination happened, sort of stemmed from there into our society, from Hindu mythology. And it's just insurance, basically. If people pointed at it saying that, how dare you put Sita in a modern day setting and make her sort of bitch about, you know, sort of Hindu mythology, they'll just say the name was Janaki, even though the short is called Sita. So I think it's the same reason on both sides of the fence. I think Om Raut, who, as we know, has made Tanaji, I think at some level, I think they were a bit conscious or a bit fearful of the fact that they might be dragged through the coals for maybe the VFX. And I think that's exactly what's happened eventually. So now they can easily sort of turn around and say, if there are any legal issues, or FIRs are going to be sort of slammed onto them and all, they can easily say that this is Lankesh and Janki and Shesh and whatnot. So it's exactly for that reason. I don't think there are any creative reasons behind it.
What is also giving me a fair bit of pleasure is that they are not only being dragged over the coals for the VFX, which is the prime offender, but also for some of the writing. And it's hilarious to me, because basically what happens in this film, so the film is a greatest hits version of the Ramayana. It starts off almost immediately laying the ground for the abduction of Sita/Janki. And there's the whole fake deer thing where Ram and Lakshman are off chasing this talking deer, and Sita gets abducted by Ravan, and you have the flashback to Shurpanaka being whose nose is maimed, and therefore Ravan is taking revenge in a way. And the abduction happens. There's the cameo by Jatayu, who I think is actually called Jatayu in this.
Yeah.
I think he didn't change his name, but...
it's a bird.
I don't know if we can call it a bird. Maybe respected, very respected mythologically. flying being. And so on and so forth. Then the whole scene shifts to Lanka, where Hanuman goes as the emissary. He goes and burns Lanka down. In the meantime, Ram and Lakshman build the bridge to Lanka and head there with their Vanar Sena. And in the end, there's this huge fight there, and they rescue Sita. So that, in a nutshell, is Adipurush, and for the most part, the writing, as in the lines that the people are actually saying, isn't too far from whatever you might have heard in like the Ramanan Sagar series or any, you know, your local Ramlila, where, you know, archaic, like deliberately archaic dialogue, which is like it sounds like something that they might have said like those many years ago. Where the film deviates, and I think they thought that, you know, they play to modern audiences a bit and particular kinds of modern audiences, is that sometimes it adopts a more informal language, and what they thought might have played really well to their core audience has actually backfired, because those same people are finding it quote unquote very disrespectful, and what is the street language that Ram is speaking, because he's like ye tere bua ka bagicha hai, and you know tere baap ka, you know, baap ka ghar hai, or whatever, and it does sound weird coming from it. But I also have to say that those were the those were one of the few moments when I think the audience was actually kind of invested in the film. Like they at least woke up when the language turned a bit contemporary and they laughed and all. They weren't probably laughing with the film. It was sort of at the film, sort of with the film. But at least there was some interest, you know, when they're speaking in your Sanskritized old Hindi and all, it's you know, everyone is half asleep. It's just that the CGI was so bad that it kept waking people up, but otherwise it's been a weird thing with these with the few contemporary dialogues that are there in this, has kind of backfired, but I enjoyed them if only for like slightly cynical reasons.
Yeah, same here. So, see, there are two things here. I feel like Om Rawat and his team, basically, as you said, you know, they decided to take a lot of creative liberties and basically disrupt the entire thing when things were happening in Lanka, right? Because Lanka is, quote-unquote, the bad place here. It's where the villain lives. And they can get away with murder there because, you know, it's Lanka. It's not around Ayodhya. It's not the jungles. So so all of these modern lines that you're talking about, the Bua ka Bagicha, or even Hanuman suddenly being like, you know, tere baap ka or something, and all of it happens in Lanka. And even Lanka itself looks like a really futuristic sort of DC film, right? Like it's so Snyder, right? And I actually didn't mind that, because I'm like, oh wait, like, of course he's taking risks in Lanka, because where else can he do it? And he's gone all out with his sort of whatever imagination there, because the parts with, you know, with Ram and Lakshman and Hanuman, and we are going to call them that for this podcast. We can't use the other names right now. It's too much effort. So all the jungle parts and the exile parts and them sort of the Vanarasena and them deciding to make the Setu to Lanka and all of them are extremely boring, extremely sort of derivative. The VFX is bad. The dialogue is like sleep-inducing. The backgrounds are like screensavers on like Windows 97 laptops. So it's just one of those. So when Lanka comes, it's just another film. It's like overcast, as you said. It's a Snyder film. The castle is also, the sort of palace is not a palace. It's like sort of a DC castle where it's made of granite and it has this modern technology around it almost. The security is sort of, a lot of weapons look very modern. Ravan looks, obviously Sev plays him like a modern character, because when does he not? And it's just, the funny part is Om Rawat decided to do all that and is, you know, they decided to do all that thinking that, of course, our audiences are sort of mythology-loving audiences, and the Sanghis and the Bucks will not really mind us messing with Lanka. And if anything, we've been very respectful to Ram and Lakshman and their and everything that's happening there. So I think it's fine to have a bit of fun in Lanka. And funnily enough, that's where most of his imagination comes to life in a way, because whether we liked it or not, Tanaji was a fairly well-made film, right? Yeah. Like it was fairly slick in terms of its action sequences. They didn't pretend to have like you know, like a lot of complex dialogue, complex premise and all. It was fairly watchable visually. And I think both of us noticed that when we watched it then. And I saw glimpses of that in the Lanka parts here, where he was deciding to take some risk. Funnily enough, he did it recklessly and thinking that, okay, I'm going to pander to my audiences and sort of maybe offend the liberals and the academics. And he's managed to offend everyone. He didn't expect people to take offense at how Ravana is portrayed or how Ravana's son or how Lanka was portrayed. And that's exactly what's happened. And it's quite amusing because I didn't expect that myself. And another thing he's done, I feel, by making Lanka the way he does, making it so vivid visually, is he's basically been taunting the sort of modern superhero genre. I don't think there's so much thought gone into it, but subconsciously what has happened with these people making the film, wanting to pander to their audiences and to the government, is the fact that by making Lanka so modern, I think he's also sort of saying that, you know, all these superhero films that you kids have grown up on are all evil and rubbish and bad. And eventually they will get defeated by our Ram and Lakshman sort of mythology, a very chaste sort of storytelling that we've done for centuries. And I think subconsciously that old versus new thing has come across in the way he's made the film, because Lanka is new, you know, everything happening outside Lanka is old. And eventually old defeats new, and tradition is basically the cornerstone of all these people who make these films are basically, that's exactly the sort of subtext they want to portray. And that has backfired as well. And nobody saw that coming either.
I like the theory actually, because Lanka really does have the modern franchise parallels. Like all your Lankeshes, Ravan's army basically look like orcs from Lord of the Rings, and his son is like going around like the Flash, and you know, he himself kind of looks like something out of 300. So you do see a lot of the Western films, like visual parallels in the Lanka parts of the story. It's just, you know, just to add to the, you know, how it is trying to play politically, which then of course backfired. But, you know, the kind of language which is used, you know, Jalina, and you know, Jomari Benu wo haath lagayega, hum uski Lanka laga denge. I mean, it's so stupid and so obvious. But, you know, considering what you know, Indian cinema is today and what India is today, I thought it would work. I thought this would play great, but it just hasn't. But it's so dumb and it's so obvious. I'm glad it's offending everybody, but you can see where they were trying to go when it doesn't speak like a complicated language. And, you know, you have Saif Ali Khan, who in Tanhaji played a Hindu who looked like a Muslim stereotype. Out here, he's playing a villain, like the biggest villain in Hindu mythology, as kind of slightly a Muslim stereotype, which is like, you know, he has the long beard, he has the under his eyes, he has the coal, and he's throwing meat, so he's handling meat. And looking at another woman, even though he has a wife and stuff. So, you know, all very obvious and tricks that Hindi cinema has been doing in the last decade. And we're almost, we're so used to it that now it doesn't even even register, because it's done so much. In spite of that, Saif is really the only bit of fun that is there in this whole film. And it just reminded me of how much fun he was in Tanhaji. In fact, he was really, really fun, because that film is also slightly better. So he's a terrific villain in that. And he's quite fun here as well. That he has any competition from anybody. So, you know, the bar is set like pretty much underground, but he was still like the only, I basically woke up when he was on screen.
Yeah, I think my favorite shot of the film, or the scene of favorite scene of the film, when he was feeding his demon bird like it was a little cat, and it was hung upside down. I think that was actually imaginative, because the camera starts on the bird like it's actually it's vertical, and then it like goes around. It basically goes. It does a full 360 to show that it's hung like a bat, and it's actually eating the meat that Ravan is feeding him, and Ravan is like going kuchiku sort of thing he's doing. So I felt like Saif was, as usual, having a bit of fun. And it's not the first time we've said this, right? Like, in pretty much all the films that he does, of course he'll go on to apologize and say, oh yeah, sure, it was a bit tone deaf for me to play a Hindu villain who is fashioned like a Mughal or a Muslim character. He will do that in the next interview. I mean, yeah, I can't begrudge him his little fun that he's having with these characters, because, as you said, it barely registers now.
I really do like Saif, because he's one of the few self-aware kind of actors in Hindi cinema. Yeah. You feel like when he's handed nonsense, he at some level he knows it's nonsense. That's certainly not a given with, like, even some of the better actors, I feel, don't exactly know that, but Saif definitely gives the feeling that he does. even in the scenes with Kriti Sanon, where she's like saying pious sort of things and threatening him that Ram will come and all, he's not being aggressive as much as kind of confused and sort of, now that I've done this big thing, what am I supposed to do next? He has this kind of, idiot jock expression on his face when she gives him all these scenarios. He's like, I don't know. I mean, I abducted you. It's like, I'm not supposed to, like, work out this complex strategy after that. He was very funny. But Kriti Sanon, of course, I think all wrong for playing Sita. I mean, it's not a part that you would want to wish on anybody anyways, but I don't know. It could have been like someone with even less personality, I guess,
Yeah, I mean, Kriti Sanon, the only thing that was coming to my mind, I was like, the wolf she played in Bheda was 10 times better than all the VFX in this film.
She was nice in Bhedia, and she does not give the vibe of, someone who'd live in ancient times, let alone really ancient times. And she's just, it feels wrong. She feels too alert for that kind of role. You need someone who's slightly dead in the eyes. And
Prabhas.
He's perfect. He's great.
He's so bad that he's perfect for that role. For the role that people want to see, the boring sort of 1980s, 70s mythology that we've sort of all happened to sort of chance upon in visual form somewhere or other. And if he has to look terribly dated and out of sync with what's happening today, sure, he's great for the role. Like, he's just running in slow motion most of the film, and his dubbing, fortunately, it's not his voice, so it's fine.
Yeah, Sunny Singh looks like he needs a hug for most of the film.
Yeah, I love that, how he was just being dismissed by his brother like every other scene. Anything he says, his brother is saying the opposite. And of course, eventually, like, it almost became like he's that sort of incompetent hero's best friend in like high school films that we see. And then eventually he's given a redemption arc for no reason. So yeah, Sunny Singh was, I mean, I think he was unintentionally modern in his role. He had that Punjabi twang going on. He brings to mind Love Ranjan's
role. It's quite a bold decision to play Lakshman as like a emo Punjabi guy with a Indian cricket team beard,
that reminded me of sort of Ravan's hairstyle also in this, right? He had a Kohli cut going on his side,
that's true. Yeah, I didn't think of that.
Very trendy, and very like sort of up to date with what's happening in the villain scene out there these days. I feel like
good innovation by Om Rao to do like the five heads on top of the five heads, you know, because symmetry.
Yeah, no, because it's too big. 10 heads. Yeah, the symmetry is all like, how would he film the 10 heads? They won't fit into the shot most of the time. So fairly good decision that way, even if the heads looked like they were all sort of in a therapy session with each other. It was okay. Like, I mean, honestly, the Lanka parts are more or less how much I enjoyed or didn't enjoy Brahmastra. And because, of course, I knew that the filmmakers were being sort of reckless. They were almost trying to offend the purists. No, when I say the purists, I mean they were trying to offend like film enthusiasts and cinephiles. But somehow they managed to offend their own. And did you see this discourse coming though?
I saw a different kind of discourse coming. I did not expect everyone to turn on it, which is just hilarious. And now, by the way, they are turning on each other. I think Manoj Muntashir, who's written the film, has after like 3 days of people questioning him about his lines, has said that actually you should ask the director, because I have to write according to what the story is. So I think now those questions are going to go to Om Rao, and apparently they are also going to rewrite and re-record the offending lines now, so that the film that people will see a week from now maybe is going to be different from the film that we saw. It'll still be crap, but it'll be different crap.
Oh man, it'll be worse crap. Honestly, I prefer the crap right now. Like it's at least we can see where they've gone wrong, and it's really unintentionally, ironically funny that they've gone wrong there. But yeah, I sort of expected that, and even I didn't see the discourse coming. I'm very surprised and obviously secretly pleased that everyone's turned on the film, because obviously it was made with sort of very different intentions, almost heinous intentions, to sort of capitalize on what's going on. And given that Kerala Files or stories were still recently, it was such a badly made film and became such a big hit. I really expected this to like go hammer and tongs at the box office, and they've been promoting it as the most expensive Indian film ever made, 500 crores. So I'm quite surprised to see the reactions right now, and also amused that people are saying, oh, it has not adhered to the facts. I was like, what facts? Like, that's the funniest part. Like, we are talking about Hindu mythology here for the longest time. They're talking about scriptures, and people are bringing up like, this is actually what happened, and this is how you sound, and this is a... So basically there's no space to have any sort of creative liberty when it comes to like holy scriptures, or when it comes to... But with history, with historicals, you can do stuff like that. The way they play Mughal characters or evil Hindu characters, you can get away with shit there. But even Akshay Kumar has been failing at that recently. So I'd say, you know, like the big budget films that have been like going all out to sort of propagate the entire Kashmir Files sort of syndrome right now, I feel like maybe they have to think twice, which is a good thing, because to see this at this scale is particularly difficult for a lot of us critics also.
Yeah, but it's not like it's being criticized for any of the right reasons by the more conservative part of the audience. It's just that they in a sense they're criticizing it for not being conservative enough. It's not like they're offended by, you know, its overtures to majority politics or anything like that. It's just like they're saying that, oh, you know, because they realize that it's stupid, it looks ridiculous, so they're just, you know, they're latching on to this idea that, oh, you know, it's disrespectful and all that. But had like everybody not been making so much fun of it, I'm sure they wouldn't have like cared that there are a few stray lines that you know, that sound like they've written by someone on a troll on Twitter. One thing which I found hopeful, and of course this may backfire because this may go on to make like who knows 500-600 crores, given that the advanced booking itself has, I think, pushed the film close to 100 crores. So who knows how much it'll make. But if it's not, like, if it doesn't really make back much of its budget, it may not encourage people to make mythologicals for the big screen. And that's really like the last bastion which is kind of left, because they've really, they've made historical that are almost mythologicals, and they've made contemporary films that are, kind of half mythological. But they haven't made, like, they haven't taken actual godly characters and made films on that. And I thought if this is, was like a runaway success, that floodgate would open, then there'd just be like 100 of those. Hopefully we've bought ourselves like a little bit of time if this doesn't do particularly well.
Yeah, that's true, actually. That's a good point, because again, you know, it's also, it's fairly unpredictable. Like, I don't even know, like, anymore how to go. So I, when I came out of, after watching the morning show.
Oh, by the way, just to interrupt you, during your show, was there like yelling? Like, were people like Jai Shri Ram and all that? There was a lot of that in mind.
No, not really. I think also some of it was down to the fact that half of the theater in the morning was filled with critics because there was no pressure. So I think a lot of us were like sort of sleepy and treating it as a job. But there was a Jai Shri Ram after the national anthem was played, one Jai Shri Ram. But I think when the movie was going on, you could sense the spirits falling. And most of the theater was full. You could sense, and they started laughing at the film in certain moments, like you said, the Hanuman parts and the Ravan parts. So yeah, I mean, I was a little, when I came out, I was a little scared. In fact, during the interval, I was a little worried that, oh shit, this is dangerous, because we've seen half of the film right now, and it isn't the worst VFX made film in Hindi cinema or in Indian cinema, because from what we saw of the trailers, I expected far worse. And by the interval, I was like, it's not the worst, and maybe people will lap this up, and maybe this is going to become the biggest hit of the year. And by the end of the film, I was fairly convinced that it's a bad film, but I was still not convinced that people will sort of turn on it. And which is why I'm quite amused to see sort of what's been happening, and everything that's happened since it's released on Friday, and the fact that they're going to change portions and all. But again, as you said, you know, it's also very difficult to predict. You said historicals being sort of made as mythos is spot on, because I feel like they still have more of a chance with historicals to basically alter facts rather than take mythology, which is more or less fiction already, and then, you know, put your own paint of imagination or like sort of post-truth, Islamophobic stuff into the film, as they have been doing. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I've been hearing about Mahabharat, big budget Mahabharat films and shows for the last 10 years. I think they'll all be thinking twice after this. And I think because of the amount of money that's pumped into it, you think Hindu mythology would be a short bet at the box office, but clearly it's not, unless you really put one of the sort of, you literally put as it was written, like in its purest form on screen, in almost like a sort of comic book or the things we grew up reading as kids also. If you just put that on screen and don't mess with one word, then maybe it might work, but then it'll be a very boring film. So yeah, it's sort of a catch-22 situation for the filmmakers, and I'm not complaining.
Maybe we should move on to Extraction 2. It's quite a week. You watched, obviously, one more than me, or maybe there were others that I don't even know of, but you saw The Flash. And yeah, who would bet on The Flash being like by far the best film of the week, which it seems to be. But that's weird. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. But maybe we can start by just talking about the first Extraction film, because I don't know if we've ever discussed this. But what did you think of that? Were you a fan?
I wasn't a fan, but you know, I sort of saw where they were coming from. It was sort of smart to base it in South Asia, mostly in and around Bangladesh, in Bombay, in a bunch of, so it was obviously novel in that sense for a lot of South Asian audiences. They did a, it was a smart business decision. I don't think it was a well-made action film by any stretch of imagination, though they did have their usual sort of massive one-take set pieces that we even see in this film. But, you know, again, it's, I feel like a lot of extraction, like a lot of the other Russo brothers, or even if one of the brothers direct or are behind films, I feel a lot of it is really thin on anything but sort of really, you know, flaunting their technical sort of skills. And a lot of it, I found a lot of their productions in the last few years, and I'm not counting the ones they've produced, I'm talking about the ones they've directed or written, have been more or less the same, really wafer thin in plot, really nothing to very derivative, and just an excuse to sort of flaunt their budget and their scale, which they have become masters of thanks to the Avengers and the Marvel films that they've been making. So I've never been a big fan of them. This one again is written by Joe Russo. The first one I remember reviewing it also not very favorably, though I do know a bunch of sort of critics and people who did like the first one. I'm not exactly sure why. And the second one is sort of almost snaps into default mode in that sense, because it's back to its favorite East European bleak locations with East European villains, with like, after sort of getting South Asian audiences on board, it made us look forward to the next one, because this was the one that used Bollywood actors in the first film, and this one just goes back to Hollywood templates.
Quite well, by the way. I thought both Ali Fazal and Randeep were good fun in it. I mean,
yeah, they were, and there was, you know, like there were a bunch of cameos in that, and I thought like it was again it was far more of a, I'd say it was far more of a origin story than
Randeep Hooda and Pankaj Tripathi.
Pankaj Tripathi. Yeah, so it was fairly like it was a sort of decent origin story to start from, but I was always very wary of how they would go forward, and this film just sort of confirmed my. It's just such a dull action film, and Russo brothers just do that all the time. Like they've been doing it. They made The Gray Man last year, and I think they made
Yeah,
it was incoherent. That was just incoherent. They made like the Priyanka Chopra show this year. I mean, they've been behind that show. So it's just very dated and formulaic. And these big one shot set pieces that are supposed to like sort of represent the extraction franchise, it's nothing new anymore. Even though like it's probably great to watch for a bit, there's a 21 minute action sequence here that sort of goes across environment, but I'm not really as sort of taken by those little gimmicks as I used to be, say 10 years ago.
It's just to give you like a quick idea of what happens in the film, if you haven't seen it, Tyler Rake is played by Chris Hemsworth, is he seems to die at the end of the last film in Dhaka, but of course he doesn't, and he's rescued by his people, and he's taken to a cabin in the wilderness where he's supposed to retire. Of course, he doesn't retire. Idris Elba turns up out of nowhere, playing a character who goes nameless in the film, and tells him that his ex-wife's sister is in a Georgian prison with her gangster husband, and he's supposed to break her out. It's so random, and it's just you don't even know what to do with plots like that. Like are you supposed to feel anything? Do you really care about these people? I couldn't even remember the name of the wife by the end of the film. Yeah. And it just seems like basically an excuse to stitch together these elaborate and frankly exhausting action sequences, and you know, I know it's rich coming from me, given that I love the John Wick films, and those have the thinnest of premises, but two things. A, they have a fun mythology. they've actually built a, you know, a weird mythology of their own, which is actually, you know, has, you know, with this whole Assassin's Code and everything, it does have a lot of it has a lot of intrigue, and it's a lot of fun, even if it's not very deep. And B, it's surrounded by, you know, genuine filmmaking and some absolutely spectacular action, and they keep varying it. And the thing that really gets me in Extraction is that the action is so unvarying, and everyone fights in exactly the same way. Everybody seems like a black ops or a special ops or a marine. They're all these huge, hulking, fit kind of gym body type people. And there's absolutely no variation. They're all dressed the same. They all look the same. Most of them have beards. And it's just this thudding action that goes on and on and on. And after a point, even the fact that it's like these long, unending action sequences, who could be impressed by this? It's just exhausting after a point. And it's, yeah, so basically he breaks his ex-wife's sister, called Ketevan, and her two kids out of prison, and then her gangster's husband's brother is a big gangster outside, and he sends everyone after Tyler to, you know, get the kids back and to kill Tyler and the wife. And yeah, and it just goes on and on and on, and it's and Chris Hemsworth is, you know, is very funny in films where he's given a little leeway to be funny. He actually has excellent comic timing. I like him in the Thor films, even when the Thor films aren't good. But out here, he just plays this grim kind of guy, and he is definitely not interesting when he's being like taciturn and you know, kind of tight-lipped and not having anything to really do besides just like kill people relentlessly. And even though they've given him a very emotional backstory with his own kid who dies and his wife who leaves him, absolutely nothing comes out of that.
No, you think, and that's, it's a good point to start, because like in a post-John Wick universe in action cinema, especially Hollywood action cinema, it's really hard to really sort of like these little streaming, you know, business deals like Extraction, because you knew Extraction, the first film, was sort of a gimmick. You knew the second one didn't really know where to go, so they just went back to what they know doing best, which is basically just be bleak and humorless and witless, and like not a smile in the film, not even like a unintentionally funny moment, just taking itself so seriously. And I know that there is a space for cinema, that action cinema that takes itself seriously, but this is not that cinema. Like, I don't think like Chris Hemsworth being like this tragic sort of ex you know, a black ops mercenary, and then coming back out of retirement, I don't think it's original enough or new enough, unless, as you said, there's no mythology behind it. It's just very basic, the world building, as we saw in the first film. He's just coming back after almost dying. The only thing is he has a like a sort of nice little platonic thing going with his agent and sort of partner who's played by Goldshift, the absolute waste of her talents.
It's just, it's nuts. And they give her like even more action to do in this film than she had in the first film. And I'm like, you know, it's nice. I mean, it's fine. You, you know, give the character something to do, but it's like, it's Goldshifte Farhani, you know, get her to do like, or get her to carry all the dramatic weight, which Chris Hemsworth can't. And instead, you know, they're giving her like people to kick and stuff like that. It's just kind of, it's not even like, you know, whatever resources you have, you don't know how to use them.
I mean, yeah, just get her to play like a dead person or a ghost. She'd have so much more dramatic impact than like than his wife in the film, whoever Mia is. And it's just coming back out of nowhere, like having to rescue his former sister-in-law. And that son was really annoying. because he is messing up really everything.
Another he's kid so who I felt could have really been like dispatched halfway through the film.
That's
becoming a bit of a
really
theme.
Hard to see. It's really hard to see kids in action films mess things up and then the adults having to be nice to them because, you know, the kids are troubled because they have a terrible dad. And why were they in prison in first place for so many years? How did things go bad? Why did it feel like they suddenly turned on the husband? Because clearly they've been living there for years and it just felt like that entire 21 minute sort of that one shot that starts from like Tyler rescuing them from prison, then them sort of a chase sequence through the jungle and then ending on a train. The thing is, 10 or 15 years ago, we might have found this really impressive, but you can see the fact that every action film is now using it as a crutch to basically tell the audience that, look, take us seriously. We are not just another tired action premise, but it is just another. And that 21 minute thing doesn't do much after you watch films like 1917 or Birdman or like all these films that have used it in as part of its language, as part of its narrative language. Film and one shots aren't as rare as they used to be back in the era of Children of Men. So it's not even like it's going to rescue the film single-handedly. And you're watching it on a Netflix screen. So you're not watching it on the big screen. It's not going to hit you like that. You know they've stitched it together and choreographed it really strictly. So it's not new anymore. And I'm worried that all these little technological gimmicks that filmmakers used to take pride in long back is not as novel anymore because it's being overused, because it's being abused in like very bland action films like this. Even in Atomic Blonde, it was more impressive. You know, like it's really hard to see.
Or a film that both of us spoke about out here in glowing terms, Athena, which has starts with this incredible one-take action sequence at the start. And the point about that one was that not only like it has to be impressive on a technical level, that any one-take will be, you know, at some level technically impressive. It had that, you know, it had an emotional pull to it. It had a kind of charge to it that lit up that scene. So like the longer it goes on, you get more and more and more wrapped up in it. And it wasn't, the fact wasn't that, oh, look at us, we are so clever that we haven't cut yet. It's that we are keeping you in this moment. Like we've changed the scenery like 5 times and we move from prison to the Molyu and even now we are in this one moment, and that was the whole philosophy behind keeping it one take out. Extraction doesn't have any philosophy behind keeping something in a one take. It's just that, you know, oh, look at us, we can do this, we can just go on and on and on. And it's like, you know, at some level then you just have to say that, oh, this is impressive. And it is impressive, but it's not, it doesn't gladden the heart. For me, it does nothing. Even the first film, for me, it did absolutely nothing. But I'd say that among action fans, it has a surprisingly strong reputation. And you think they'd be more used to it, but no, it's like it really did have a strong... it did very well, you know, for Netflix. And in the years to come, people did keep talking about it. But for me, it did nothing.
Yeah, I think the pandemic had a big role to play in Extraction being a big action film.
It was also, I remember correctly, the first like really big action film that went directly online. That was, you know, not embarrassing. That wasn't like some nonsense with The Rock or Statham or something. Which was kind of impressive on a technical level and which couldn't be dismissed, and which was a commercial, commercial success. And it was a little earlier in the game for big streaming films which were like action extravaganzas.
I think things have changed since then, but it's like the Russo brothers are fairly stubborn in there because they've tasted so much success with the Marvel franchise. It's just it's obviously anything outside the Marvel franchise really hard to sort of first of all get invested in their, oh look, we can do so many things because we've helmed superhero films now, and the storytelling is weak as ever, and it's just and what is Idris Elba doing in this film? He's just coming the beginning and just sort of teasing for the next 10 extraction films that I'm going to be a character in those films. But it's and of course this is going to go on because the first film, as you mentioned, was so successful for Netflix allegedly, but the thing is, at some point it's going to get like the fatigue, the same way the superhero fatigue is sort of turning away audiences from, say, big Marvel films or DC films right now, or maybe not like attracting them to the theaters as much. I feel like the same thing is going to happen in streaming, especially these Russo action ones or the other ones similar to them, where, you know, rights are solely owned by Amazon and Netflix. I don't think it's going to sort of last forever, because the most of them had their origins during or in and around the pandemic, and the world has sort of opened up since then and people started going back to theaters. So I don't see how this sort of formula is going to continue, and you can't make a film as with such lack of self-awareness like this film. You know, there's nobody in on any joke. Chris Hemsworth is like, he's just gone the other way. Like, he's become the opposite of what he was in the Thor franchises. And it's just, it's tough to watch. I found myself like almost nodding off during the action sequences, which never normally happens. Like, at least during the action sequences, you want to see what rubbish they do, how they destroy a new European city. But here the action sequences are so endless and long. Like, you can just go get your lunch, go take a snooze and come back, it'll still be going on. And there were three big action sequences that sort of bookended this film, and it just got very repetitive and boring after a while.
It's and also I don't think the Russo brothers are very good writers. It's just I haven't seen Citadel, so I have no idea what they've done with the series, but post Avengers, I mean, have they written anything of any note? It's instead they've done like two extraction films and The Gray Man, and as writers, and none of it is particularly good. And there was a Tom Holland film, I think, in between, which I didn't see, and it's none of it has been imaginative. And I mean, they do better work as producers by attaching their name, but I don't think they're really helping anything they're doing by writing. I don't know. Sam Hargrave, of course, did so well with the first film that you can imagine why he didn't want to change a thing except the setting and just kind of double down on whatever happened in the first film. But, and I guess you could also understand why they're making it such a sober film with like very little humor and very little, you know, any kind of diversion of any kind. And because that's done so much now with most of the superhero films and, you know, a lot of the other action films, that maybe they just wanted to make like this completely stone cold kind of very grim kind of action film. But it just does not give any joy. It's just this kind of relentless, unending, unvarying kind of plod towards a conclusion. And after two films, do I care at all about Tyler Rake, let alone like some other relations of his and all? Not at all. I felt more about Adam Bessa's Yaz than I did about any of the characters in this film. I thought he was fantastic, and you know, he seems to have pitched his performance at the correct level, in the sense that, you know, it's not like he's a jocular character, but at the same time he's not taking the film entirely like so grim as Chris Hemsworth is. And I thought his was, I think, the only good performance in the film. I'm also I have a soft corner for him after watching him in this Tunisian film called Harka. I had seen it at the Kerala Film Fest, and he's the lead in that. And my God, he is absolutely fantastic in that one. I'd really recommend that people check it out if they can find it anywhere.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it makes it a little disorienting when you've seen him in such a good film, as you said, and then see him in like a franchisee like this. But he does have a presence, especially his character in this film does have a presence. And it's nice that they sort of made it a little about him towards the end of the film. But again, that was just like blink and miss, because it just felt like nobody is affected towards the end. And they just want continuity into the next 3 or 4 films. I mean, who would have guessed, as you said, you know, like I watched a bunch of films last week, and The Flash, which is the new DC film, and it resets the DC universe, which is basically like dumping whatever has happened before this. All the DC films that have happened before this, they just reset it with Flash. They're starting all over again, spiritually at least. And that was by far the best film I watched last week. And I'm not saying it's a great film, but they, again, DC is basically doing what Marvel's been doing for the last couple of years. They've started their own multiverse. Of course, they haven't called it multiverse yet, because Marvel has already done that. So they have little nods to that. And it's time travel, this film. It's more or less, there are a lot of nods to Back to the Future in this. And so it's very basic in that sense. But I found myself fairly entertained by the film. I thought it was a good start for DC. But as we speak, I'm just been scrolling through Twitter earlier today, and I noticed that this film has bombed at the box office. And why am I not surprised? Because it's the best DC films in ages. And it's just, it's a bit, it's not alarming in that sense, but I do think it was far more creative than the bunch of Marvel films that have been using the multiverse lately. And I'm not talking about Spider-Verse, that wasn't technically a Marvel film. So for those of you who did, or who have watched Spider-Verse, across the Spider-Verse, the second one, a couple of weeks ago, do catch The Flash and, you know, let us know what you thought about. Uday, you've seen both of them, right? And you've seen one of them. And
no, I've seen Flash Spider-Verse. Need to go and catch Flash, though I'm toying with the idea of going and seeing Spider-Verse again in the theaters while I can.
Yeah,
because
same, yeah.
I don't think I'll... I don't think there'll be too many films that I see in the theaters this year that will give me as much pleasure.
That's true. So, yeah. So, as you heard, like, Spider-Verse, we still recommend weeks later. Do watch Flash if you have a chance. Let us know what you think and how you connect it, at least in your head, to what's been happening in this whole multiverse storytelling across both DC and Marvel. It's an interesting time. Even I've been watching a couple of their films last year or so. So it'll be interesting to see where DC heads after this. They've done what Spider-Man No Way Home did in terms of their Batman universe in this film. They've gotten a bunch of cameos from old Batman. So I pretty much didn't mind that film last week. But as we just discussed, Adipurush, Extraction 2, disappointments as expected. And was there anything else you'd like to add about Extraction 2?
Oh, no, nothing. maybe just jumping back to Adipurush, go check out like better Ramayan films. There are some very interesting adaptations. There's this documentary that I saw years ago called Anek Ramayan, which was absolutely spectacular. All it did was chronicle the very many different versions of the Ramayana that are there, like in India and other countries. It just and the variations are almost infinite, from everything, from like changing gender to like a minor character becoming like the lead. And it's just spectacular. It's a lovely documentary. I don't know if it's, hopefully someone just like dropped it on YouTube or something. Excellent documentary, Anek Ramayan. And of course, there's the Sita Sings the Blues animated film. Been written about a lot and deservedly so, very interesting. A kind of feminist jazz film, comedic take on the Ramayana. Very interesting. So yeah, and that's there for free officially on YouTube and a couple of other platforms, so that can definitely be watched. Instead of wasting your time on Adipurush, I think these adaptations should give you a lot more.
Lovely. That documentary sounds fascinating. I'll definitely look for it. Just a last question before we wrap up. Were you big on mythology, especially Ramayana and Mahabharata, while growing up as a kid?
No, I really wasn't. So I'm really at a loss. Even during this screening, I was like, okay, which one was Vibhishan and what's Ravana's son called and stuff. So I really wasn't. Did you grow up with reading much mythology?
I mean, not in its purest form, but I did read a lot of Amar Chittakathas and the comic books Ramayana and Mahabharata. My grandparents were heavily into it, so I grew up in Gujarat. So they sort of, for me, it was really fun because I used to love reading a lot of Archies and Peanut and a bunch of things on the side. But I also, my grandparents sort of got me into this little world of Hindu mythology. And back then, of course, it was very innocent, and things have changed since then. Everything is sort of little... has an agenda right now, but it's I enjoyed sort of growing up on these visual little representations of Ramayana and Mahabharata. As a child, I used to be very familiar with a lot of characters. So, I mean, and I'd be lying if I said, you know, it's my that passion for those stories sustained into adulthood. And even I was a little confused while watching this Adipurush and sort of trying to, as you said, you know, trying to familiarize myself with the characters and the very famous events. But yeah, I wouldn't say I'm nostalgic about it anymore. But I do have fond memories of growing up on especially those two. And it's not surprising to see that we've never really pulled off a very successful modern day sort of portrayal of either. So yeah, I'm not really holding my breath there. But for those of you who do listen to, do try to look for those records and instead of watching Adipurush, and do try to watch Spider-Verse and Flash when you have the time. That's pretty much it for our podcast this week. We just discussed Adipurush and Extraction 2, and we'll be back soon discussing maybe whatever is releasing next. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.